there is a life beyond the EVM. So I think my market prediction is over the next 3 to 5 years, especially as these next-gen L2s on Ethereum and next-gen L1s really take market trends. Everyone in the EVM system is needing to adapt because next-gen VMs are simply better. They're called next-gen. They have higher throughput, better scalability. So the thesis is, I think 2023 is the year of alt DAs, and I think 2024 is actually the year of the VM, where people wake up and realize the EVM isn't the end-all be-all, and it's actually better user experience on their EVMs.
This episode is brought to you by Helium Mobile. They've created a crypto-native phone plan for unlimited talk, text, and data for just $20 a month. We'll chat more about them later in the show.
Before we get moving on today's episode, just a quick disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast by either myself, my co-host, or any guests are their personal views and do not represent the views of any associated organization. Nothing in the episode should be construed or relied upon as financial, technical, tax, legal, or any other advice. Okay, let's jump into the episode. All right, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Lightspeed. We are joined today by Rushi, the co-founder of Movement Labs, which is building a network of move-based blockchains. But we got some big news today, Rushi. You guys have just announced a $38 million Series A round. So first of all, congratulations. That's awesome. I think that's one of the larger, you probably know better than I, but I think it's one of the larger raises in recent times in the like high throughput space more broadly. What was the pitch to investors, man? Like what is really at the core of what you guys are building? And I'd love to get the problem that you guys are solving as well.
I need a quick background, kind of us and our mission, right? So me and Cooper were two like idiot college kids about 2 years ago. I was a freshman, Cooper was a senior. I was just early builders. I've been coding since I was 14, got into Cosmos and Ethereum early on, just engineering and Cosmosism and Solidity. And quite frankly, it was horrible, right? Like the user experience, developer experience, high gas fees. I think everyone involved in the early Ethereum days kind of knew that the EVM wasn't great, but kind of went along with the ride until it became a bottleneck. So then I was a freshman in college and I read this article that said like Facebook is building a programming language to power the stablecoin for billions of users on Facebook. And that kind of got me going, right? Because I was used to like these small blockchain environments that really had no users, had limited bandwidth in terms of performance. And here Facebook was building a new framework to really address that. So like August 2022, I built one of the first applications, an app testing system, which for those that weren't familiar, spun out of the DM project, which is from Facebook. And then my co-founder built like a Yarn fork on top of the app testing system. I think from there, it was like post-FTX that really got us going, that we really love Move language. I'm happy to get more into the thesis later on, but Move is designed to be the fastest and most secure VM on the market. Obviously, a block SDM, which has inspired many of the recent innovations in parallelization, like Monad, even Polygon POS at one point, have been inspired from block SDM. So bringing that to Ethereum, as well as the whole formal verification ground, really looking to be the most secure way to deploy smart contracts. So kind of the generic pitch and narrative to investors and public was, look, Ethereum is good. It has liquidity, it has security, but a smart contract developer environment on Ethereum is flawed. Transaction fees are way too high. It requires fractal scaling to even remotely scale, which needs like L3s, L4s, L5s, which makes no sense. And B, the security is really flawed. There's $4.5 billion lost every year in smart contract hacks. And my thesis was, how do I get my college friends to use crypto, right? Anytime I bring it up to them, they're always like, if I buy ETH and put it on chain, it's going to get hacked, which to be fair is a good and fair assumption to have. So I think Movement is really pushing forward two main angles on Ethereum, the speed, next-gen narrative for parallelization, and smart contract security, which unfortunately isn't as hot, but we're trying to make security sexy again.
That's the tagline of the century. Let's make security sexy again. So actually, I want to unpack why that is, because a lot of the times you hear people trade off between these newer, maybe more secure, more performant VMs and the EVM. The pitch for the EVM is kind of like, yeah, well, the developer tooling is more robust, right? Foundry is like ingrained in the process and developers enjoy it. And there's a lot of developers that center around the EVM. Do you think most of that, as far as, yeah, both of those things, really, the fact that there's a lot of developers there today and the tooling is at least has been being iterated on for a couple of years now. Is that just a function of like the EVM being first, and that's kind of what everyone had to coalesce around for there to even be like a smart contract building industry?
I mean, if you look at the early days of Web 2, like the oldest programming languages have the most, you know, have the earliest developers, have the best tooling. But we're looking at a very small lens, right? So if we're able to kind of take a step back and realize that this is a byproduct of we're in an early industry and EVM was like first to market and you got early developers and early tooling that isn't that great but good enough, then you kind of say like, okay, there's actually other languages that can quickly surpass the tooling and benefits of the EVM. I think Solana VM is the best example of this. I think Solana is kind of the cycle has shown the A is kind of the hub for developers and even users these days. And B, like there is a life beyond the EVM. So I think my market prediction is over the next 3 to 5 years, especially as these next-gen L2s on Ethereum and next-gen L1s really take market trends. Everyone in the EVM system is needing to adapt because next-gen VMs are simply better. They're called next-gen. They have higher throughput, better scalability. So that those like core infra providers like the MetaMask, the Infuras, the Coinbase custodies of the world are all going to understand that and eventually migrate over. And we're already seeing that with Solana, Aptos, and Sui today.
Mostly the transition has been EVM was first. Solana really proved the SVM was valuable and you could get some increased speed, right? They introduced parallelization at the execution level. And then like, what is the next, like what is the evolution of Move? Like what is that really unlocking? Is it additional performance or is it really on the security and the security side of things?
Yeah. So I know Aptos and Sui are working on like addressing the congestion things we're seeing in Solana. So I think they already have a fix right now with how they're doing transaction batching and consensus. But really what we're focused on is security, right? So you had like the SVM and these parallelized VMs really fix the localized fee, but fix it with localized fee markets and parallel execution for higher throughput purposes. Move has those same benefits, if not better, but also focus on security. So, for example, the EVM is $4.5 billion lost every year. In smart contract hacks, I think it's total like $7.8 billion. And it's already with like only 10 users on chain. So if we ever get to a point where we actually have real capital, real users, my mom is going to be comfortable deploying funds on top of the EVM. Even the SVM is great, but there's been numerous attacks like Cypher, and there's every attack probably like a month. Whether it's like smart contract exploits or just general like Rust-based framework issues. Move is designed with the Move Prover built into mind, which is one of the most important innovations in form verification history. Essentially, for those that aren't familiar, is the Move Prover lives within the VM and checks for bytecode and memory safety correctness. So traditionally, when you have a smart contract, let's say, for example, there's an integer overflow in the EVM, there's nothing stopping that smart contract from executing. So like Curve, Kyber, these blue chip DeFi protocols on EVM, they were fine one day. There was a new batch, a new push in GitHub that kind of updated their state, updated contracts, and there was a human error issue. I think in the case of Kyber, that was like a 99.99% attack vector, where like there's pretty much no, like it's actually 0.001% chance of actually finding it. So I think for that, it's like, it comes down to human error ultimately, which you need a software to kind of monitor. So the Move Prover from the Move VM checks for runtime safety. So it's a unique benefit that helps for account checks, safety checks. The easy example is to run in-depth account checks for the Move VM. It takes about 10 lines of code. For like Solana, it takes about like a page or so. And then EVM takes like weeks to even do end-to-end account checks. So the velocity production for the Move VM in terms of security trade-offs is much quicker.
And is it just not possible to say, okay, you know, to effectively create, to bring these security unlocks back to the EVM? Like, why does it make sense to like kind of evolve away from the EVM and build these new languages versus going the other way where you're kind of like bringing the innovations back to the EVM?
Yeah, so we actually support EVM as well. One of the core theses of Movement is that we acknowledge EVM as legacy code. Curve, Aave, Uniswap, these blue chip DeFi protocols have a clear PMF on the EVM. And if you want to use Curve, it's probably best to use it on the EVM today. Even though there's security issues, there's still the most amount of liquidity there and users there. So with that, we have an EVM interpreter. So you take this literally 142 opcodes, you map it to 54 opcodes, and you're able to do EVM translation directly on the move VM. So what that enables is we actually have backwards compatibility for any Solidity code. So if you want to deploy Uniswap on us, you have Ethereum based on RPC, MetaMask compatible, it works, talks, and looks like an EVM. So we can support legacy contracts, but it's clearly marketed that if you want higher performance, if you want better security, you have to write Move. So with that dual kind of approach, we have short-term solvency for the cold start problem we see with next-gen VMs. And we have long-term solvency because we're doing a lot of developer adoption and pushing forward the Move narrative in markets that have never seen it before.
All right, let's take a quick break to talk about Helium Mobile. Every month, I'm reminded of the pain of a phone bill for someone who is terminally online. Those data charges are no joke. Well, Helium Mobile is bringing a crypto-native solution to this. It's powered by a combination of a decentralized wireless network and the nation's largest 5G network to bring reliable coverage to its users. The coolest part for me are definitely the mobile token rewards. They're earned by sharing a location, which allows more people to build coverage where it's needed most. So effectively, the token rewards end up bringing a better product to the customer. But even cooler, you can take these rewards and pay for your phone bill directly within the app. This is a beautiful showcase of arguably crypto's two strongest use cases, incentivized user action and crypto payment rails. The phone plan is unlimited talk, text, and data, plus it's affordable at just $20 a month. If this sounds interesting to you, go to hellohelium.com to get 3 free months of service with the code LightSpeedMobile. Again, that's LightSpeedMobile, all caps, no spaces. Be sure to check out the link in the show notes for easy access. All right, guys, let's get back to the show.
Okay, that's really interesting. So let's say on a chain built on this stack, which we'll get into here in a second. Let's say, like, you know, I write a contract in EVM, you write a contract in Move. They both live on the same chain. Like, there's still full composability between those two contracts, right?
Yep. So there's two main things. A, we have a shared sequencer. So let's say, for example, you have an EVM app-specific app and you have a Move app on the main rollup hub, which is Movement Fraction L2. We actually have a shared sequencer that can seamlessly route transactions between the two different rollups. And second thing is obviously the two different token standards. You have Aptos Coin, which is the Move token standard, and you have ERC20. We have something called Universal Token Standard, where we're able to put wrappers around the Aptos Coin standard and make it look like ERC20. So we're able to essentially do atomic composability between any, let's say you have Tala, which is Aptos, and you have Uniswap, which is on ERC20, obviously. They will function the same.
Gotcha. Okay, so you couldn't then. So that would be two separate rollups. But could you have a single rollup that was like leveraging both languages as well?
Yeah. So the main product is Movement, which is a Move layer to an Ethereum. Think of like Optimism. And if you have, let's say, like Tala, which is an Aptos protocol, Move protocol, and then you have Uniswap, they can interoperate because it's one token standard called a Universal Token Standard.
Sweet, man. Okay, so that's a good segue. So let's talk about the stack here. So to me, it feels like a rollup framework that also comes with a native shared sequencer. Is that a fair description?
I think it's just a Move L2 with a rollup framework. The playbook is very similar to Optimism, where Optimism is the main rollup, where liquidity is, liquidity hub, that's Movement. You have OP stack, which is a rollup framework for launching rollups. We have the Move stack, which is an execution layer framework, which is actually compatible with all different rollup frameworks. And you have a shared sequencer, which is our M1 or the Optimism cases, so Superchain. So TLDR is you have a flagship rollup called Movement. It's a Move VM on Ethereum. You have a shared sequencer that sequences a layer 2, as well as a layer 2 is a joint network. So kind of the end vision is this network of Move-based chains. But today, and the focus until mainnet, is just launching the Move rollup on Ethereum.
Awesome. Okay, no, that's good. Let's start with the Move rollup on Ethereum then. So what does that look like? Are you using Celestia for DA, or where is the data availability happening here?
Yeah, the current architecture is Celestia with DA data availability. At the time of DevNet and TestNet, Celestia is only live. AggieDA went live last week. So the thesis is, I think 2023 was a year of alt DAs where you had people challenge Dang Sharding and say it's going to be too far ahead, and Celestia and AggieDA and Avail came to market. And I think 2024, I like to call it, and I actually called it 6 months ago, is actually the year of the VM, where people wake up and realize the EVM isn't the end-all be-all and it's actually better user experience on their EVMs. So the architecture of the main Movement chain is you have Move EVM for execution. It's a Move VM with the EVM interpreter on top of it. So we call it a parallelized Move EVM. You have Ethereum for settlement. You have Celestia for DA. And you have M1, which is our sequencer that sequences layer 2.
Awesome. Okay. And so, you know, you mentioned that the fractal scaling idea of like having L2s and L3s live on top of the L2s doesn't make a ton of sense. Why don't you think that makes a ton of sense? Like if you were an L2, do you want, like you are an L2, right? So you have M2. Do you want people to build L3s on top of M2?
I think we're all welcome to do it. If you want to do it, like Godspeed. But I think it generally doesn't make sense, right? The whole thesis of parallelization and having multi-threaded processing is that you can actually have as specific threads. If you have, let's say, an inscription events going on one thread, it shouldn't affect the user experience when you swap another thread or a game another thread. That's the thesis behind any kind of parallelized VMs. So if you have, let's say, in traditional EVM, you need fractal scaling because, let's say, you have a really big app on base, that's going to clog the network because it's only one thread. So you need your own L3. But then the issue comes, what if the L3 clogs? Then you need L4. And then with the L4 clocks, then you need L5. So it creates this constant demand and need for infrastructure, which is quite frankly unneeded. If you simply optimize the execution layer for the layer 2, you can have processing for multiple threads within layer 2. So you don't need multiple rollups. So you don't need multiple infrastructure. You don't need multiple nodes. You don't need to pay all infrastructure costs. You can simply optimize layer 2.
Right. And so when you think about that vision, that kind of aligns more with even like the Aptos, Solana, Sui vision, where it's like, let's juice this layer and like maximize the throughput we can. So how do you think about the value trade-off between, you know, building like an Aptos or Sui or Solana as an L1 versus building movement as an L2 or building the M2? Like what are the trade-offs between the two layers there?
Yeah. So I built one of the first decks in Aptos. My co-founder also built the first yield dagger in Aptos. And when we launched, the biggest issue was we had obviously APT and test and token, like I touched on. The trade-off, the benefit of launching a layer 2 and doing it in a modular fashion is this concept of like permissionless innovation, where if I want to launch my own custom app rollup, I want my custom Oracle provider, I want my custom bridging provider, I don't need to wait for a foundation or centralized entity to do that for me. So my biggest issue building on a layer 1 is that I wanted to bring IBC into my app, but I couldn't, because it's highly dependent on top of the layer 1 at the time, which is Aptos. They all have their own missions. It's not like a downside to them. They have their own narratives and things to push. But as an app builder with my own specific needs and my own target audiences, I want to be able to choose what assets are on my application, right? So with that, that same Dex that I built on top of Aptos can now deploy on top of Movement. You have Aptos and Sui, both protocols and both tokens, which was a big issue in Aptos because for those that aren't familiar, Aptos and Sui were completely different languages, similar bytecode, but different languages. So for example, we're now combining both Aptos and Sui on Ethereum. So that's already a big benefit. The second benefit is that you live on Ethereum, you have a native ETH, you can actually jumpstart liquidity for your user base. So we actually have several near 80 to 100 million of TVL already committed. And this is from family office liquid funds that didn't feel comfortable deploying funds in the past. And now because it's layer 2 architecture, it's living on Ethereum security, and you have form of verification built into the VM, they're actually able to bridge directly ETH to layer 2 and have it in a trust minimized way. So that same DEX can have native ETH, ETH liquidity, EVM liquidity, and EVM assets. So the same DEX can have Aptos assets, Sui assets, native ETH, EVM assets, and we're actually working with Union to be fully IBC compatible. So we'll have USTC off the bat, TIA, Atom. This, you can see kind of the case I'm making, right? You have 30 to 40 more assets and asset classes, which makes the DEX a lot more useful.
What was it like getting IBC integrated to an L2? Because my understanding of that infrastructure, that construction there is, it kind of relies somewhat on the chain speaking like the Tendermint consensus language. So what was that experience like?
Yeah, this is more like Union's role. What they're working on is ZK IBC. So okay. They can essentially bring IBC to layer 2s on the networks. So with that partnership, they're bringing out Sol like client machines that can read the execution as well as read the settlement state. So they're able to essentially take the IBC state and generate proofs that are able to communicate between, let's say, our rollup, Asmosis, the Cosmos Hub, Celestia, or any other Cosmos native protocol. I'm a Cosmos guy, I'm a Cosmos maxi, but I think the original Cosmos look was we're going to do all these Cosmos zones. The issue was those were all different Confederate states that had no centralized force behind it. My general thesis, and I've tweeted about this, is Cosmos is the internet of blockchains and achieves that not through Tendermint, but through IBC. So IBC actually wins, and it's the most secure and trustless and actually like no like central authority behind it, bridging protocol. And you have all these transport layers on top of it, which can be layer zero, wormhole. We've seen every major bridge adopt IBC, and unions kind of directly bring native IBC to us.
Okay, no, that makes sense. And so as a Cosmos maxi, you got to be passionate about like app specific block space. But like, isn't the L3 vision sort of that? Like you want to live on top of the L2 because you need your own kind of space. Like, how do you think about the trade-off between like the app specific space, but the benefits of being in like a shared state layer?
Yep. So that's exactly why we had to move stack, right? So we have some high profile candidates and partnerships we're announcing shortly. They're launching their own custom move stack rollup. So what that means is they can use whatever roll framework, they use OPStack, CDK, CK stack, whatever, use whatever DL layer. We're not competing on that. My general thesis is that those both areas are crowded and raced to the bottom usually. We're actually just focusing on execution layer. So right now, a lot of those kits are focused on do whatever, but use the EVM. We're saying do whatever, but use a parallelized VM on top of that. So we have a few big clients launching a move EVM rollup, use whatever role framework, use whatever DL layer, and connect to the shared sequencer. So my thesis is that L3s don't make sense, but custom L2s that connect to a shared sequencer make a ton of sense. If you're a deepin project, an AI project, gaming project, you need your own block space, you're correct. But you don't need to build on top of a layer two. Just launch your own layer two, have your own community, have your own tokenomics, and stop paying rent to random EVM L2.
All right, so we have M2 as the flagship L2 that's sort of like dogfooding the stack and getting it to market and proving it works. And then you're going to say, okay, well, come build with us. And I want to get to the shared sequencer layer after this, but let's start with the roll-up framework stack. So how do you think about like who should build? Like, should it be more general purpose chains? Like, you know, I think OKX just launched their exchange layer. You know, Coinbase obviously has Base. M2 is like seems to be a general purpose chain built on top of Ethereum. Like, how do you think about more general purpose chains versus more app specific chains?
I think, well, a general purpose chain is like where liquidity is usually like the TVL, the go to market. Base is kind of an anomaly because they have the Coinbase distribution, so it can actually like surpass Optimism. But it's also the vision, right? We envision the biggest consumer gaming and high profile apps have their own custom block space, their custom rollup. They want to have their own narrative. They want to be say that they're actually L2, not connected to another narrative. So I think the general purpose L2 is for like the smaller projects, the DeFi projects that need just kind of a springboard. So DEXs usually will deploy on top of the general purpose L2, liquid staking, lending markets. These are kind of general purpose DeFi apps, as well as like any game that's trying to like start off and be within a community. But once a game, a social app, or even like an order book reaches escape velocity, and they're like, hey, we actually have users. So think Avo, Hyperliquid, DYDX. Once you reach that kind of level, it is in your interest to have your own block space, have your own tokenomics, and have your own kind of chain. So with that, the general purpose L2 serves as a springboard. And then once you're at escape velocity, you just launch your own chain of the stack. So we actually encourage rollups to join the network, start off on a layer two, kind of get your grounding. If you're a DeFi app, you probably stay longer. But if you're like a gaming app, we want you to eventually migrate to your own custom block space because that's what's in your interest.
And then when building an L2, you know, today there's two different paths basically that are most commonly taken, an optimistic path and a zero knowledge or a ZK's path. And they have trade-offs. And today, you know, a lot of the optimistics use their validity proofs as like fraud proofs where you basically assume everything is true and you give everyone like a 7-day window to make a challenge if a challenge is found. I don't think a challenge has ever been found in practice. And so that's model seems to be working. Of course, there's trade-offs on some people don't actually have fraud proofs live, but we'll assume that they do for now for the sake of this discussion. And the other route is ZK. And ZK seems to be faster, but more expensive. So how do you think about the trade-offs between the two and which one kind of wins out over the long term?
Yeah, so our current architecture is ZK fraud proofs. So it's kind of like the Venn diagram of zero knowledge and optimistic role, like fraud proofs. The benefits of ZK fraud proofs is you don't have interactive verification game. You can prove a single block as a fraud proof. It's very cheap because you're not running the proof every time you're doing a transaction. You have fast withdrawals and you have like cheap transaction fees. So the current integration for the rollup and the rollups that we're launching is the ZK fraud proofs. It doesn't really make sense to use ZK next-gen VM at the moment because let's say, for example, you have a cent for each transaction you're doing. If you're doing like 10K plus TPS, it's pretty expensive. So current ZK infrastructure just can't support a next-gen VM really. But we eventually vision in a 5-6 year lens that we're going to build out a ZK move VM directly from scratch with our own circuits. But today, ZK fraud proofs are the best way to do it. So my general thesis is like optimistic rollups are really good, right? Like no one really cares about the challenge period. Like what I learned really quickly is this contrary belief is like no one really cares about decentralization, no one really cares about security often, and actually a struggle that we're facing, right? Like we're trying to make security sexy again in an industry where like Munchables happens, which is a hacker attack of 50 million, no one bets an eye. Or like things like rollbacks happen for layer twos and it's kind of bad, but not really because users still use it anyway. So in a long-term landscape, yes, validity proofs are the best way to go. ZK rollups are the best way to go. And that's where the market needs to head. But today, user experiences don't really care about that. So the question is, how can you deliver the best user experience? And what we found is that ZK fraud proofs is kind of the perfect middle ground where you're able to essentially have the lower withdrawal times, have the better challenge periods, have the better security assumptions, but not have to pay like insanely high proving costs for validity proofs.
To play devil's advocate, you know, if you wanted to truly give the best user experience and no one cared about decentralization, like just run a server. Like, why does it have to be Web3?
Exactly. That is a question I actually ask myself a lot, but I think ultimately people want to be on chain. People want to transact on a blockchain with a distributed network. Like, it's not like people don't completely care about decentralization. Like people still care that Solana is distributed. People still care that Ethereum is distributed. They can run their own nodes. They can participate in governance. Like these are principles from the Ethereum early blockchain days that still apply. My reference is like, I generally push back on like the concept of being too, like you need to be Ethereum aligned. You need to prioritize decentralization and censorship. You can never break the law. I agree that as long as you have some form of decentralization, you maintain the general rules, you should optimize for user experience. So if it's like 0, which is like completely not decentralized, and 10, which is fully decentralized, it's okay to be a 6 or 7 and just optimize for user experience instead of going all the way down the right to 9 and 10 and focus end to end on this Ethereum alignment, on focus end to end on this what's right and not actually having any users.
Right. No, that's like a far too reasonable take to have. What are you doing? So we have this stack that enables you to build or users to build more chains that all go down to this shared sequencer. And before we hit the shared sequencer, one of the problems that exists today with Ethereum's rollup landscape is the fragmentation of It gets called the fragmentation of liquidity, but quite frankly, when you have, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 rollups with over $1 billion of liquidity, like that's not the problem. The fragmentation is the fragmentation of applications. And me as a user, I want to use something on Base, then I want to use something on Arbitrum, and then I want to use something on ZK Sync. And now I have all these bridging transactions that it's just not, at the best case scenario, is an extra transaction that I have to run to get somewhere else. So, and at the worst case scenario, it's a fucking miserable experience because it doesn't work. My funds get lost, yada, yada. So how do you think about the interop solution? I know you mentioned IBC, and as a Cosmos Maxi, you know the benefits of having good interop. So how do you guys approach that at Movement Labs?
So with the shared sequencer, I think that's kind of the better direction in business where you have multiple nodes that can sequence layer 2 as well as layer 2s. So the vision is for Movement Network to merge this leading shared sequencer network. We have big rollups that join the network. And if you want to use an application on one rollup versus another rollup versus another rollup, it's actually a seamless experience because you have one centralized or one shared sequencer. But obviously, like there's going to be other networks. Like Arbitrum's going to have a shared sequencer. Optimus is going to have a shared sequencer. ZK Sync's working on a shared sequencer. So you have all these like big layer 2s with their own ecosystems launching their own shared sequencers and respective ecosystems. So the question is, how do you connect all these different ecosystems? There's a few groups that are working on these things. I know you obviously have like Wormhole, Layer Zero, which are the traditional bridges, but obviously there's some pushback on that with token standards and user experience. You have the IBC route, which has better user experience, but it's been mostly constrained to just Cosmos right now, but this team's working on bringing it out. I think my general thesis is just, I really like the chain abstraction. The kind of go-to-market where I know Near's working on it, it's Light Protocol working on it, where if you want to simply use any app on Arbitrum, Movement, ZK-Sync, whatever, there's going to be a higher-level interface that allows you to kind of navigate between different chains in one click. So we're working with some teams there. Shared sequencers are great, but that's like within our Movement ecosystem. So if you want the best UX within apps in the ecosystem, use our stack and state within the ecosystem. But if you want to go beyond that, I think it's going to be a combination of chain abstraction. Chain abstraction also connects to like intent space. So if you're using a DEX, that's like intense DEX, you can essentially swap between different chains and networks at ease. And the last thing is like, I really believe that IBC takes over as like the most secure bridging protocol and bridging standard. So if you have like Arbitrum, Optimism, Movement Labs, all eventually is going to be IBC connected. And it's going to be a similar feel like to Cosmos today, where you have like Osmosis, Juno, et cetera. And it's pretty easy to do swaps. I think that's the experience that once IBC has escape velocity, we're going to see that in borrowed Ethereum today.
Cool. And so let's dive into M1. M1 is the shared sequencer. The architecture there is built on an Avalanche subnet. So what was the decision to use the Avalanche subnet for this layer? Let's start there.
Yeah. First of all, we don't really call it a subnet. A subnet is defined as something that stakes the AVAX, which is the token from Avalanche, as well as our native token. With the new proposal, we will be just staking our native token. So similar to just like a Veil uses Substrate, but it's not a parachain. Parachain uses Cosmos CK, but isn't a zone. We use the security assumptions of Snowman, but we're using the shared sequencer and we only stake our native token.
Okay. So just to jump in right there. So basically like you forked the Avalanche infrastructure and then created it like a move VM on that.
It's not a fork. It's actually like part of Avalanche's agenda. Like they're now enabling subnets to not require to stake AVAX.
So like ACP13.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
ACP13. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. So you guys are like basically subnet only validators within the Avalanche ecosystem, and then you're building on top of the infrastructure that they have. Okay, sorry. So you're talking about Snowman Consensus.
Yep. So we market as just using Snowman Consensus. The validators that right now are extremely low hard requirements. It's very decentralized. You actually inherit all the security that exists on the current Avalanche ecosystem, but we don't have to stake the native token, so there's no price action requirements. It's just our native token. The validators take the token. As part of the sequence network, we're going to have like 100 nodes to start off with and eventually permissionless. The validators take the token, and then those that take the token can sequence the layer 2 as well as other layer 2s that join the network.
Okay, awesome. And are you guys like paying attention to all the work they're doing with like the Hyper SDK, and they have like a new transaction processing mechanism called Vrix that's just now they just put out the benchmarks. Like, is that something that you guys are looking at and eager to integrate? Or is it mostly on the consensus side that you're like, look, Snowman is a very scalable consensus and that's what enables us to be powerful?
Yeah, we're not really focused on execution. We're simply using Snowman for decentralization. Snowman has one of the best consensuses in terms of finality, and that's really important for our shared sequencer. Execution, Vrix is great. They're doing a good job with Hyper SDK and kind of performance upgrades, but we're not really involved because M1 is an execution environment. Only Movement itself, the main M2 rollup, is the execution environment, so we don't really focus on that.
Okay, now that makes sense. And then what is like the high, what is the pitch on why shared sequencers are valuable? Because this is something that I consistently struggle with, is like, what is the unlock that having multiple rollups plugged into the same shared sequencer, like what is the benefit that is driven back to the rollups?
Yeah, so I'm generally bearish more shared sequencers as like a B2B play, because every major layer 2 is working on their own shared sequencer, right? My take from a shared sequencer within the ecosystem, it makes a lot of sense because Current centralized sequencers are pretty broken. For example, if you look at inscriptions, Arbitrum went down like 100 TPS, ZK-Sync went down 120 TPS, and that's because sequencer level issues. So downtime is really bad for centralized sequencers. B, the tokenomics are pretty bad. So most L2 tokens are meme coins and just governance tokens. There's no actual buy pressure or value accrual back to the token. So with a decentralized or even shared sequencer, it actually creates a new tokenomics because validators have to stake the token to get sequencing fees. So it actually creates buy pressure because validators stake the token, they participate in sequencing fees, they get emissions, and they can use those sequencing fees to run more and more nodes. So it's actually incentivized to hold the token, stake the token, participate in network, and it's beyond just a governance meme coin token. So the two answers there are performance and liveliness and tokenomics.
Why does the roll up, what is in their best interest to opt into this layer? Because, they have to pay sequencing fees. So like, what do they get in return for the sequencing fees? Is it really just like, hey, we're going to have better liveness guarantees. And is there interrupt at all unlocked in having your transactions? Like if roll up A and roll up B use the same shared sequencer, do they get any like interoperability unlocks between the two?
Yeah. So the second point, you get much better interrupt, like near one block atomic composability. So if you're swapping from one, if you're on dex on one roll up and on dex on another roll up, you can do one block swaps, which is much more effective than waiting multiple blocks for a traditional bridge or trust assumptions there. And the first point is on like, what do they give economics? So because we have a validator set, we enable dual staking. So traditionally, like if you're like launching a custom, let's say a gaming roll up, and you launch your own roll up the stack and you connect to shared sequencing, you can actually use your token to stake in conjunction with our Nano token. So say, for example, you have Dan coin. You can stake Dan and stake Move within one node. And both those, and as a validator, I stake both. I earn sequencing fees for both movement as well as the Dan chain. So that enables me to earn multiple incentives. And from a chain point of view, I actually have the same buy pressure tokenomics point of view that I was just discussing.
Okay, so that's really interesting. Is that kind of the target audience for who's going to run a node on the sequencing layer? It would on M1, like ideally the rollups run a node and like participate in the shared sequencer network, or would it be like third parties? Like the popular validators today, like let's say a Chorus One or a P2P, or both.
We're going to start off with a security network to have like the third party providers, but the vision is to eventually be permissionless. I really want to push for the next year or so, a fully permissionless decentralized sequencer where like Avalanche is right now, what it is right now, right? Anyone can set up an Avalanche node and participate in the network. That it should be that case for Ethereum layer twos, where if I want to sequence the Movement network or the Optimism Superchain or the Arbitrum Orbit network, I can set up a node on my laptop. I can stake the ARP token, the Move token, the OP token, as well as the chains I want. So let's say, for example, I'm a validator that loves gaming. I stake the Move token, I stake the token of respected gaming chain, and now I get the token emissions from both the gaming chain as well as the Movement rollup. If I'm a DeFi guy, I stake the DeFi token. If I'm an IO guy, or if I'm an AI guy, I can stake the AI token.
Do you think there's power laws around these things over like a long enough time horizon where, you mentioned that, Arbitrum's going to want their own shared sequencer and Polygon and the Optimism, the OP stack network, right? Superchain. Like, how do you think that plays out? Like, because in a perfect world for like the user, like you'd probably just want one. So everybody was on the same thing. But like, again, the incentives aren't there for that to be the case.
Yeah, I mean, you're creating competing environments, right? So that comes down to the BD. In a 6-month horizon, it looks competitive and looks like, why is there 30 different L2s? In a 2-year horizon, it is a survival best fit. The chains, the ecosystems that can get the best chains are going to get the best people on their super chain. So right now, I would say that's like OP's in the pack because they have both Optimism and Base. And once they create the shared sequencer, that's a pretty attractive hub for a current DeFi hub. Orbit's doing a good job with the consumer and other focuses. So I think it comes down to BD play. So long-term horizon, it's survival the best fit is. And ideally, I think only 2 or 3 systems actually make it out.
Yeah, that makes sense. I want to zoom back out from the tech for a second here. And like when you as a founder think about the challenges that you're going to face over the next year, like what are going to be the hardest hurdles to overcome? But if you like hit this landmark, like, all right, like now I'm feeling really good about the state of Movement Labs.
Yeah, I would say current Move market penetration is like 3 to 5%, or probably 4%, I would say on average. by the end of 2024, I want to hit like 10% in terms of move market penetration. So right now, say it's like 50-60% EVM, like 30%-ish, 35% SVM, and the rest is alternative VMs or other programming languages. I would like move with hopefully our initiatives and kind of what we're pushing forward to get like 10% by the end of the year, and then next year probably get to like 20%. If we can hit that in terms of developer count, I feel like as an individual, we've been able to do something that a lot of organizations haven't been able to do, and B, like we're able to actually get the Move programming language into developers today. But I think it's less about like taking the market penetration, right? Like we don't want to fight over the same 1,000 devs. We're trying to bring in new devs to the ecosystem. So another metric we're tracking is net new devs that weren't Web3 devs. So Web2 devs that we actually converted. And I think a narrative that we have that no one really has is like, Facebook will move, right? This is Silicon Valley. It's a Palo Alto. Is the language for consumers, right? It's also the most intuitive for Web2 developers to pick up. So those are two metrics that we're really tracking, is that if we can bring in and actually lead the metric I guess I'm excited is if we can lead the percentage in most net new developers growth rate, I think we're getting somewhere. Like if the EVM is only bringing in 10%, if Slack is bringing in 20%, if Move can bring in 50% by next 12 months, those are new devs that are bringing something net new to the blockchain ecosystem. It's not predatory vampire devs that are jumping on from EVM to EVM fork. But B, it's actually like we're doing something good here, right? We're pushing forward new innovative technology that has a chance to dethrone everything.
No, that feels like the right goal to be pushing towards. And you know, you mentioned Solana, or is the SVM is, you know, roughly 30-ish percent. That is all feels like it's been relatively recent. The last 12 months have been like what feels like an awakening of, yeah, okay, like there's always been these next-gen VMs and like people talking about it and, you know, the ideas of, you know, bringing in like Web2 base level standards, like parallelized execution and bringing that into Web3. You know, that was always something that sounded great on paper, but now we're seeing it like actually play out. And so that makes sense. But if we get specific here, like, you know, if your goal is to onboard net new devs into Web3, like how do you do that? Is it like, yeah, what are the initiatives that you need to deploy and run to actually pull this off?
I think it starts for us from an ethos point of view. Like I think that one of the issues that I faced starting off in like monolithic layer ones is big foundations, big capital formations. And it feels like developers aren't connected to the founders, connected to the core team. And there's like really bad DevRel support. I think like we are prioritized from a grounds up point of view, like being like Web3 native, like very meme culture, embracing that part of life. Cause like today, like meme coins are like one of the biggest use cases of crypto, right? And a lot of chains don't really embrace that. Like we wholeheartedly embrace like the TGN meme culture because that's how you get people excited in the short term. In long term, like you're gonna do the same things like hackathons, accelerators. But the question is like, we don't want like vampire devs, right? Like this is like the issue with EVM is like, okay, cool, you launch a hackathon for your new EVML 2, they'll hack for 3 months, ship a product, and then go to the next new chain that's hot. With Move, we kind of like, we're focused on like getting them to learn Move, pick up Move, and like pick up Move skills. So that once they learn Move, there's pretty much like they're kind of stuck to the ecosystem and they like commit to the ecosystem. So like developer education is really important. So like I touched on, we're really focused on onboarding like Web2 developers, like doing hackathons, accelerators, and audiences that would never really touch crypto. And that's what's coming over the next 2 or 3 months. And in the short term as well, is like we are even compatible. So we're going to play the same game of like, okay, how do we get developers writing Solidity and experiencing the movement network and the parallelization thesis and the better user experience. The first major unlock is like realizing that you can have Solana-like experience on Ethereum. So a lot of developers are going to love that. Users are going to love that. And the second main unlock is how to get new Web2 developers that haven't touched the modern day ecosystem.
Right. No, that makes sense. And what were the takeaways that you had from building a Move-based application on an existing L1? Like what were the shortcomings of that experience that kind of led you down this path of being like, all right, like I've noticed that these problems exist and I have an opportunity to kind of go build something that really takes that to the next level. Like what were the actual pain points that you faced?
From a go-to-market point of view, liquidity concerns, like if you're building a layer one to launch post like in the depths of the bear, liquidity is pretty hard to get. Most family offices, liquid funds, market makers really only feel confident on Ethereum-based blockchains in the bear market. Like you look at Aptos, Sui, Say, even Solana in the bear market, TVL was pretty rough. Because just generally people didn't believe in alt VMs. I think this time around it'll be a lot easier, but still, it was a big concern. Like, how do we bring liquidity to our dApp? And for any dApp that's trying to fundraise, the number one protocol any venture or user asks you is, what's your TVL? If you're on a chain with a TVL like 100 million, you probably don't have the most attractive app. So learning from that, I was like, okay, I want to still build a next-gen VM app, but I want Ethereum liquidity. I want to be in Ethereum security. So that's the first kind of go-to-market. Second thing is more from a community point of view. I think, like, I hate Ethereum aligned. Like, I don't like saying the word, but it is a marketing term, right? Like, if you are leveraging Ethereum security within Ethereum communities, right now, that's where liquidity, users, and kind of mind share is outside Solana, Layer 1 itself. So there is like a clear go-to-market strategy in being Ethereum aligned, at least for short term, where you're able to say, onboard liquidity providers, onboard users, onboard influencers and people who primarily use the Ethereum block space. And then from there, scale to a vision beyond that.
Right. No, that makes sense. And where do you think we are in like the quality of the infrastructure cycle? So, you know, if you like rewind to 5 years ago, you couldn't have built an application that 1,000 people can use at the same time on chain. It just wasn't possible. And now we're getting to the point where it is possible. But like, if we look at Solana, you know, meme coining got pretty hot over there. And they kind of like crapped out around, you know, somewhere between like 1,000 and 2,000 TPS, which is probably the best. That's the best. It has the best sustained TPS we've seen in crypto. Like Sui, I think, hit 66 million transactions in a day, which is, as far as TPS goes, is like the highest single day TPS. But of course, it wasn't sustained by any margin. And so, like, I guess my point here is 1,000 to 2,000 TPS is still not like, you know, to get Facebook on chain, right? So yep. How much further do you think we need to go to get to a place where we can actually have these large applications that have Web2 scale but are occurring on a Web3 platform?
Yeah, so first of all, like, I don't get the FUD around Solana. Like, Ethereum people are like backlashing Solana. I'm like, my response is, it's bullish that Solana's going down, right? Like, they actually have users on chain. Wow. They actually have block space that's filled. They actually have market demand. It's like, if your website goes down on Web2 from overuse and like going viral, that's not bearish on the developers. That's bullish for the go-to-market distribution. So first of all, hats off Solana, totally, Raj, et cetera, crushing it. I'm sure they'll have a fix up shortly. It's actually a great step into actually getting users on chain. Second thing is, like, I think infrastructure is getting a lot better. Like you touched on, like, we couldn't do 2K TPS 5 months ago, or 5 years ago, a year and a half ago, there was no place to do Rust-based VM on layer two. So like a lot of like the OP Stack Magic clients, a lot of the ZK stuff that we've seen recently wasn't there a year and a half ago. We're getting to the point where infrastructure is at, like, I would say 70% there for Facebook on chain. There needs to be like probably another year and a half of performance optimizations. Solana's going to do it on the consensus and fix up the validators and stuff. And like layer two, I guess, are focusing on execution environments and making that hyper parallelized on Ethereum. I think in around a year and a half, infrastructure will be ready for Facebook on chain. And the kind of movement thesis and the kind of move shield here is, like, we're all here saying Facebook on chain, Facebook built move. So like the block STM pattern, optimistic parallelization with block STM is much more easier to use and easier to work with than Solana's parallelization model, because obviously it's not optimistic and you have to be more hands-on there. The developer experience is much easier. So if you want Facebook on chain, try using the language Facebook built.
I love that pitch, man. Rushi, this has been a fantastic conversation. You guys are doing some very impressive work at Movement Labs, and I love the prioritization of both performance and security. Yeah. Good luck in your endeavors of making security sexy. I'm very bullish on Movement Labs, but that piece is a hard task. No, I'm kidding, man. Again, thanks for coming on. We'll put some links to your Twitter profile as your great follow, as well as that of Movement Labs. So thanks again, man. All the best, and cheers. Have a good one.
Thanks so much, man. Thanks for having me.